Hey there, welcome back. Today, we're taking a deep dive into some seriously heavy stuff. The warnings of judgment found in Jeremiah chapters 4 through 6. It's all about the impending invasion of Judah. We've got excerpts from a lecture by Dr. Gary Yates, who really breaks down the history and the theology of it all, and even makes some interesting connections to modern times. So if you've ever wondered about the consequences of ignoring warnings, or how events from thousands of years ago can still speak to us today, this is the deep dive for you.
I think what's really compelling about Jeremiah is that it's not just some ancient history lesson. It grapples with these timeless questions about human nature, the consequences of our choices, and ultimately the power of God's word.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, is in a downward spiral, right? They turned away from God, embraced all kinds of bad stuff, and basically ignored all the warning signs. But why is this story from so long ago relevant to us today?
That's where the principle of sowing and reaping comes in. It's this idea that our actions have consequences, especially when it comes to our relationship with God. Dr. Yates draws a parallel to the book of Judges, where the Israelites failed to drive out the Canaanites like God commanded. They ended up absorbing their pagan practices and faced a whole series of judgments. It's like this ripple effect. One bad decision leads to another, and before you know it, you're facing some serious consequences.
So are you saying we're all walking a tightrope? And one wrong step could send us tumbling?
Right.
Because that's a little intense.
Well, it's not about living in fear. It's more about understanding that there's a cause and effect to our actions. Judah didn't just wake up one day and decide to rebel against God. It was a gradual process, a hardening of their hearts, a persistent turning away that eventually led to this point of no return. Dr. Yates points out several verses in Jeremiah where you can see this playing out, like Jeremiah 5:3, where it says, "They refuse to take correction. They have made their faces harder than rock. They have refused to return." And again in Jeremiah 6:10, quote, "To whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Behold, their ears are uncircumcised. They cannot listen. Behold, the word of the Lord is to them an object of scorn. They take no pleasure in it."
So they were given chances, clear warnings even, but they just didn't listen.
Exactly. And what's interesting here is the idea that God's word can sometimes act as a judgment in itself. It's not that God is forcing them to disobey, but the very message that's meant to save them ends up exposing the true condition of their hearts.
That reminds me of the story of Pharaoh during the plagues of Egypt. Each plague, instead of softening his heart, just seemed to make him more resistant to God's message.
Right. Dr. Yates uses this powerful phrase, "God often punishes unbelief with further unbelief." Every time we reject truth, we create another layer of resistance in our hearts. It's like we build these walls that prevent us from seeing clearly and responding to God's grace.
So instead of softening us, our stubbornness can actually make us more resistant to change. I mean, I know I can be pretty stubborn sometimes. Are we talking about individual stubbornness here, or more of a collective societal thing like what was happening in Judah?
I think it can work on both levels. But let's stick with Judah for now. One thing that really struck me about Jeremiah's message is how he uses these powerful judgment speeches to convey God's verdict on the nation.
Hold on. Judgment speeches. Is this like some ancient courtroom drama? I need a little more explanation here.
Think of it as a two-part structure: accusation and announcement. First, the prophet outlines the sins, how the people have gone astray. Then comes the announcement, the consequences they'll face.
Okay, so it's like a divine court case. Yes. First, the charges are laid out, then the verdict is delivered.
Yes, exactly. And Dr. Yates uses Isaiah 5:8-25 as an example. The punishment often fits the crime, mirroring the nature of the offense. We can see this play out in Jeremiah 5.
Can you give us an example of this punishment fits the crime idea?
Sure. Judah was steeped in hypocrisy. They swore oaths in God's name while their hearts were far from him. Their words were empty. As a consequence, God declares he'll make their words like fire, consuming and destroying them.
Oh, their own words used against them. Talk about poetic justice.
Right. Jeremiah doesn't just list their sins in a dry way. He uses these incredibly vivid images to paint a picture of their rebellion and the consequences that are coming. And this is where the description of the invading army gets really interesting.
Okay, so we're talking about this invading army. It sounds like Jeremiah doesn't hold back on the imagery here. It's pretty intense stuff, right?
It is. And that intensity serves a purpose. He's not just giving a military report. He's using these powerful metaphors to convey the sheer terror and destruction that's about to unfold. The enemy army is likened to a lion, a wolf, a leopard, all these fierce predators known for their strength and ruthlessness. Imagine hearing that and trying to feel safe in your home.
Yikes. I'd be shaking in my sandals for sure. But it's not just about individual soldiers, right? Dr. Yates mentioned this comparison to a scorching east wind to Sirocco. that will blow away everything in its path.
Exactly. It's like this unstoppable force of nature indiscriminately wreaking havoc. And it gets even more intense when Jeremiah compares the devastation to the unformed earth before creation, like in Genesis 1:2. It's almost like God is going to hit the reset button on creation.
Wow. It's hard to even imagine that level of destruction. But what really stuck with me was the description of the invading nation itself. They're described as ancient and powerful, with a quiver like an open tomb. That sends shivers down my spine. What do you make of that?
It's such a powerful image, isn't it? The quiver, normally a symbol of military might, is twisted into the symbol of impending death. It hints at the massive loss of life that's about to hit Judah. And what's even more unsettling is that at this point in the book, we don't even know who this invading nation is. It adds this layer of mystery and dread to the whole prophecy.
It's interesting how these metaphors, even though they're from thousands of years ago, can still evoke such a strong emotional response. But there's another layer to this invasion, isn't there? This idea of the day of the Lord and divine judgment. What exactly does that mean?
The day of the Lord is a big concept in the prophets, and it's not always easy to grasp. It points to a time when God intervenes in human affairs, bringing judgment and justice. Dr. Yates explains that this phrase can refer to both an immediate historical judgment, like the Babylonian invasion of Judah, and also to a future ultimate judgment at the end of time.
So it's like a dual meaning, both a near and far horizon of judgment.
Exactly. And you have to remember that the Israelites had this idea of the day of the Lord as a day of triumph for them, where God would come down and wipe out their enemies. But prophets like Amos and Jeremiah flipped that expectation on its head. They said, the day of the Lord is coming, but it's not going to be a party for you. It's going to be a day of reckoning, a time when God confronts your sin and rebellion.
Whoa. So instead of fighting for them, God would be fighting against them. That's a pretty radical shift in perspective. I can't imagine how the people would have reacted to that.
It was a shocking message. Imagine being told that the God you thought was your protector was about to become your judge. It would completely shatter your worldview. And the prophets didn't sugarcoat it either. Dr. Yates highlights Amos 5, 18:20, where Amos compares the day of the Lord to someone running from a lion only to run into a bear and then getting bitten by a snake while hiding in their own house.
Talk about feeling trapped. Sounds like there's no escaping judgment when it comes to the day of the Lord. It makes you wonder if we sometimes try to do the same thing today, compartmentalize God, put him in a box, and ignore the parts of his character that make us uncomfortable. Like, maybe we want a God who blesses us but doesn't challenge us, who supports our side no matter what.
You hit the nail on the head. We tend to want a God who conforms to our desires rather than the other way around. But the God of the Bible is a God of justice, righteousness, and holiness. And sometimes his love means confronting us, shaking us out of our complacency, and even allowing us to experience the consequences of our actions.
So the day of the Lord, while it sounds terrifying, could also be seen as an act of love, a way of waking us up to the reality of our situation and the choices we're making.
I think so. It's a wake-up call, a divine intervention designed to get us back on the right path. And it's not just an Old Testament concept either. Dr. Yates connects the day of the Lord in Jeremiah to the final judgment that Peter describes in 2 Peter 3:10-13.
Yeah, where Peter talks about the heavens disappearing with a roar, the elements melting with fervent heat, and the earth being burned up. That's some pretty intense imagery.
It is. And it reminds us that every historical judgment, every day of the Lord throughout history, is pointing towards a greater ultimate judgment that is still to come.
That's a sobering thought. But how are we supposed to live with this knowledge, this awareness of a looming judgment? It's easy to feel overwhelmed by that and just give in to fear.
I think Peter offers a powerful antidote to that fear. He says, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn? He's basically saying, look, this world is temporary, so focus on living lives that reflect God's character, pursuing holiness and godliness.
So instead of cowering in fear, we should be motivated to live differently, knowing that this world is not our ultimate home.
Exactly. And remember, Peter doesn't end with doom and gloom. He goes on to talk about new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. The day of the Lord is not just about judgment. It's also about renewal and restoration. It's the culmination of God's plan to make all things new and establish his kingdom of righteousness and peace.
That's a much more hopeful way to look at it. It reminds us that even in the midst of judgment, God's love and faithfulness never fail. But we've been talking about a lot of abstract theological concepts. How does all of this apply to our lives today in practical terms?
That's the key question, right? And Dr. Yates challenges us to really wrestle with it. He says that every judgment in history, every day of the Lord in the past, serves as a reminder of God's ultimate judgment and the importance of living in light of that reality.
So we shouldn't just dismiss these events as ancient history. They actually hold valuable lessons for us today.
Absolutely. If we ignore the warnings of history, we risk repeating the same mistakes and facing similar consequences.
So how do we apply these ancient lessons to our modern context? It's easy to draw parallels between Judah's idolatry and our own cultural obsession with things like wealth, status, and pleasure. But how do we move beyond those surface-level comparisons to deeper, more meaningful applications?
That's where things get really interesting. And it's a perfect place to pause and pick up in our next segment.
All right, so we've journeyed back to ancient Judah with Jeremiah, explored the warnings of judgment, and unpacked this heavy concept of the day of the Lord. But the real question is, how do we take these ancient truths and actually apply them to our lives today? Feels like there's a lot to unpack here.
You're right. It's not about simply slapping a modern label on ancient sins and calling it a day. We need to dig deeper to examine the underlying principles at play.
So less about matching up specific sins and more about understanding the patterns of human behavior, the heart issues that lead us down dangerous paths.
Exactly. For example, we talked about Judah's idolatry, their worship of false gods. It might seem easy to connect that to our modern-day obsession with material possession, status, or even technology, but I think it goes beyond just the what. It's about the why.
So it's not just about what we're chasing after. It's about why we're chasing it, what's driving us.
Yes. The deeper question is, what are we putting our trust in? Where are we seeking security, meaning purpose? If it's anything other than God, anything that takes precedence over him. It could be considered a form of idolatry, even if it doesn't look like the traditional image of bowing down to a statue.
Wow. That really makes you think about your priorities, doesn't it? What are you truly devoted to? But let's shift gears a bit and talk about the idea of judgment. We live in a culture that's pretty uncomfortable with that concept, especially when it comes to God.
It's understandable that people struggle with the idea of divine judgment. It can feel harsh, even vindictive, especially if we have this image of God as a kindly grandfather figure who just wants us to be happy.
Right. But the prophets, especially Jeremiah, paint a different picture, don't they? A God who is both loving and just merciful and righteous.
Exactly. And I think that's where we often get tripped up. We tend to emphasize one aspect of God's nature at the expense of the other. But as Dr. Yates pointed out, the day of the Lord is not simply a day of wrath and punishment. It's also a day of purification, a day of reckoning that ultimately leads to restoration and renewal. It's about God's desire for us to be made whole, even if it requires going through some difficult things.
So it's less about God punishing us and more about allowing us to experience the natural consequences of our choices. Consequences that are actually designed to wake us up and draw us back to him.
That's a great way to put it. It's like a loving parent who lets their child touch a hot stove, even though it hurts, because they know it will teach them a valuable lesson. The pain isn't the goal. It's the catalyst for growth, for wisdom, for change.
That makes sense. But does that mean we should be constantly looking over our shoulder, waiting for the day of the Lord to come crashing down on us?
I don't think it's about living in fear or paranoia. It's about living with an awareness of our accountability to God, recognizing that our choices have consequences both in this life and the next.
So it's about living intentionally with a sense of responsibility for our actions, knowing that we're not just answerable to ourselves, but to a higher power.
Precisely. And it's also about living with hope. Yes, judgment is a reality, but so is redemption. God's love is always greater than our sin, his mercy more powerful than our failures.
So even when we mess up, even when we face the consequences of our actions, there's always a path back to God. There's always hope for forgiveness and restoration.
Absolutely. That's the heart of the gospel message. It's not about condemnation, but about hope and restoration. No matter how far we've strayed, no matter how much we've messed up, God's love is always there waiting for us to turn back to him.
Well, that's really encouraging. It's a reminder that there's always hope, even when things seem dark and hopeless. But I have one final question, and it's a big one. Knowing that every historical judgment, like what happened to Judah, reflects a greater coming judgment, how should that shape our perspective on current events and how we live our lives?
That's a question I think we each need to wrestle with personally. For me, it's a call to live with a sense of urgency, to make the most of the time we've been given, to invest in things that matter, to love deeply, to forgive freely, to pursue justice and righteousness, and to share the hope of the gospel with a world that desperately needs it.
That's beautifully said. And I think it's the perfect note to end our deep dive on. We've covered a lot of ground today, explored some challenging concepts, and hopefully gained some wisdom that will help us navigate the complexities of life and our relationship with God.
It's been a fascinating journey, and I hope you'll continue exploring. The book of Jeremiah delves deeper into the concept of the day of the Lord and consider how these ancient truths can shape your life today.
Absolutely. So until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.